Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the weekly Frank and Stan chat. This is edition 181, and it's the 21st of March, 2024. And those of you watching the video will see that at the bottom of our screen, we have a guest. It's Sarah Davis. So, Sarah, hello. Thank you for joining us. We've met once before, somewhere in London, I think it was, at a conference organised by James Mannion, I think. So what were you doing there?
So I was there, and it was my first time at the Rethinking Education Conference, actually. Really, really good and informative conference. And I was there to discuss my interpretation and perspective and the research that I've been doing around oracy. So it was great to be able to share that with people like yourselves and to be able to have those discussions.
Yeah, and it struck a chord with me. I was in the session with you, and it was very topical as well, and it looks as though it's going to be continue to be very topical as we move forward. So we'll get on to you getting a bit of a sort of presentation about, or a description about what you're doing and where you are. But Stan, before we get to that, we always say, how are you this week, Stan?
I'm good. How are you, Frank? Because we rarely ask how you are.
As you know, this is an unplanned chat, and I have to say, last Saturday, my brother, who has been a guest on here twice before, a former HMI like me, he passed away last Saturday. And it's taken a little while to sort of get through all this, to be honest. It was still a surprise, and he's been one of our best guests, hasn't he, really? Yeah. I think you said, Stan, if you'd met him before me, he would probably have been your mate.
If I'd met him at the same time as you, he would have been my mate.
I know. But anyway, so I'll do it when I feel sort of more inclined, and we'll do a sort of formal thing about Barry. But anyway, thank you for asking. I'm sorry it wasn't a bit more upbeat, but that was what's been on my mind. Sarah. So what do you actually do? What's your job? And tell us a little bit about the book you've written as well.
Absolutely. So first of all, my condolences, Frank, obviously.
Yes.
Now, when we talk about the book and we talk about what I do, I am, at the moment, I'm an assistant head teacher over at a secondary school in the Northwest. More, you know, if we was to zone that down, in Oldham. So some people might know it. We frequent the papers. A bit, but I absolutely adore it. I absolutely adore the students.
How long have you been there?
So I've actually been at this school now for 7 years. I am an army child, but I was born in Oldham. So my experience is always quite a unique one when I think about the fact that I'm an English teacher as well. So I was born in Oldham, but I was raised in Germany on an American army base. Even though I'm an English teacher, some of the spellings I still struggle with. So, you know, so colour, I actually have to stop myself. Even if it's on the board, on the whiteboard, if I write it, I will still look at it and go, you know, Zeds have a place in my heart. But at the same time, you know, I was raised with yellow buses and, you know, Oreos for breakfast. So it's one of the, you know, it's a catch 22.
Did you have an American father or mother or?
No, so both were in the British Army. It's just
which station was it? Whereabouts? What was the base called?
Düsseldorf. We were based in Düsseldorf. So when I came back over, I was still in primary school. I was about seven when we came back over, and we've just we talked earlier about the fact that I went to university in Preston and things. I just always seem to gravitate back towards Oldham. There always seems to be something that's pulling me back in this way. But I do think a lot of it is to do with, particularly work-wise, a lot of it is to do with the students that we've got and the fact that they, you know, if you buy into them, they buy into you. And that is so prominent when you think about, you know, students, particularly if they require anything like free school meals or they have that pupil premium. Stigma around them, you know, that actually they just want that consistency and they want to be able to share that with you. So, you know, off the back of that, a lot of my focus has gravitated towards oracy because of the fact that I think more often than not, it's a neglected skill. I do think that there is an argument to be had over the fact that what a lot of the education system at the moment doesn't do is take into account just how fundamentally important it is in order to make that progress going forward. It's very much like the chicken and egg style, isn't it? We have the same argument with reading skills and this recognition of the reading skills as we should do with the oracy skills, that actually, in order to progress with an academic subject, they need to have those foundations there and they need to be able to do it right. Because what we need to do is prepare our students for life after school. I think the moment that we look at a situation and we go, okay, let's get them to their GCSE results, then actually we might as well not be teaching, we might as well not be educators, because actually what we're doing is we're teaching to a specific parameter. But actually, when we look at developing those skills and giving them the confidence to be able to, articulate themselves, to be able to have conversations, it's so much more than that. So yeah, so oracy is a massive part of that for me, because what I want is to, to support the development of well-rounded, citizens, as opposed to just getting those letters on that paper. I want them, whatever that letter, whatever that number is on that paper, I want them to be able to then go into a job interview or go into a college or hold down a relationship because
Yes.
they're able to have those conversations. So yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, Stan and I have been asked about, well, it's been occasionally we've been asked to write, think about writing a book. Well, I don't know how we find the time to do it, to be honest, but I mean, you have written a book. So, I mean, tell us a little bit about that, talking about oracy and actually, what's the secret? How do you find the time?
Well, there is quite a story behind this one, and it does not make me sound like a professional. No, so basically, I love, like, first of all, disclaimer, I absolutely love my family. I really do. I have two young children, one's 13 and one's 5. Fabulous husband who supports me every step of the way, and a loving mother who is my loving mother. And the thing is lockdown happened. And yes, so lockdown happened, and my loving mother, who I love very dearly, once she got the grasp of lockdown, because I think that was the case with a lot of people, like, actually grasping what it meant. I do remember having that phone call with her where I was trying to explain to her that, we are actually, we're going into a lockdown. You can't go to bingo next Saturday.
No.
It's not going to be open. And it took a lot, but once it sunk in, the next minute we ended up doing a very quick drive-by on the day of, very quick drive-by to pick up her four suitcases and a budgie, standard. And at the time we were living in a townhouse. We were really fortunate. Obviously, we had enough rooms for all of us. We did. So my mother had to move in with my eldest. And it very much became a very, very packed household. So, we were really fortunate, like I said, that we were all together. However, my youngest, he was born in 2019, so I had just come off maternity leave when it all happened. And I needed to find a reason to be in a room by myself. So I had kind of twofold. So I had very much this idea of I'd become infuriated by the suggestion that spoken language and that, was the responsibility of the English teacher, and that was what we had to do. Because when I came back, it was that time of the year where all of them have to be filmed, and we have to do speeches, and it became a burden and an add-on, and it was perceived as this kind of, this thing that had to be done for the sake of it. There was no The building of the schema around it, there was no real power and passion behind it. And when you're talking to practitioners in every single place, then you're hearing the same thing. So there was very much that part of it, and I had started doing a lot of research and writing a lot of articles for it, and I kind of, got the feeling, I liked the idea of the articles. And I did notice that, if it was writing, then I had an hour by myself or two, or so I don't know. Yeah, it ended up being a book. I think it started off as an article and then it just carried on and it carried on. But, so yeah, no, and like I said, it was just a culmination, really, of you pick it all up as you go along, and you really talking to and the opportunity to talk to so many practitioners as well, because I do think that that was something else that the entire situation allowed me to do, was to be able to have conversations with practitioners across the country just by jumping onto a Teams call or a Zoom call with them. And to be able to talk about the different strategies that they were using, how we using it going forward, and more importantly, because then it kind of it went full circle, because then it started thinking, well, we've got students at the moment, and we do, we still we st we are still teaching students at the moment that spent a good 6 or 7 weeks, couple of months, not speaking to anyone. So we've got a lot of skills there that we need to really help and support on.
So, yeah, I mean, going back then, when it all opened up, you've got the book behind you. Your actual sort of knowledge is and awareness has increased. I mean, were you like a bull in a china shop, wanting to get it all changed, back at
I
school?
wish there was, and I mean, but that's the frustrating thing with oracy in general. Like, the more that you begin to really fall down the rabbit hole of its significance, its importance, the different components that need to be attached to it, what it really means, how it can be, how it supports with the educational levels. As soon as you realize all of that, you become increasingly frustrated about, misconceptions or misunderstandings, or, you've got to spend a lot of time working with people to identify what it is not, in order to get anywhere with what it is. Because it's very easy when you do go full bull in a china shop style. And it's like I mentioned at the presentation, it was, and it wasn't long after that, was it? Like, it wasn't long before that that everything had blown up because of Keir Starmer's 5-point review, and this idea of even just, any politician referencing spoken language, the world went into to chaos. UK went into chaos. Like, oh my gosh, what is this? What is this thing that we need to do? And it's and unfortunately, in some circumstances, the first thing that then happened was then people met and went, okay, we're going to create a debate club. We're going to,
Oh
we've done it. And
no.
yeah, and that's always it's always something that's so frustrating in a way, because you can't be a bull in the china shop with it, because you run the risk of people perceiving it as tokenistic, or not embedded. And it's about really getting to the root of why it's important as well.
I'm thinking now back to my, this is going back in the dark ages,
Oh, here we go.
when I was teaching in primary. But I used to do things like set up play opportunities for year six pupils to encourage them to talk about things. So we had a travel agents, for example, in the corner of the classroom, and children were timetabled to go and play. And I did a paper on it at the time because I was assessing at the time speaking and listening, and I was using that opportunity to say, right, these children, middle of Salford, actually have a second language that they can use if they're in that circle. Children would answer an imaginary phone in fantastically classic language, whereas outside on the playground, it would be a completely different type of language that they would use. And I'd never realized the capacity to be able to do that until I sat down and observed them at play, on a formal play, if you like, because the occasion, the environment was set up for a particular set of conversations.
I remember when, again, going back to that work in the co-op, I've mentioned this before, but it fits so neatly. I'm going to say it again. We used to have sort of hundreds of children on work experience for 2 weeks coming in from Stoke, from Leeds, first experience on the train, having to come in as a year 10 on the train from Stoke to Manchester. We'd collect them at the station, walk them back, and then what have you. But at the end of the 2 weeks, they had to do a short presentation on what they'd learnt as a group. And after we'd done that for a couple of years, somebody said, "Well, I've got a friend at I won't mention the independent school, but I've got this friend at independent school. He's heard about it. Is it possible to have six or seven of their students coming in as well at the same time?" And I said, "Oh yeah, that's fine." So we ended up with this presentation at the end of 2 weeks, and the children who gained the most, the young people who gained the most, were actually the kids from Stoke and Leeds. They did. But the kids who could present it were the ones from the independent school. If you could dig a hole in the back of the wall, the kids from the academies that we had them from, they'd dig that hole and they'd do the presentation about four rooms back. Whereas the independent school kids, right at the front of the stage, able to present it, they've obviously done this frequently. They were sort of on it. They'd seen people presenting. They convinced themselves they were going to be in a position where they would have to do that going forward. I'm not saying every child was like that, but there was just a marked difference between the two. I mean, you can see it. I see it with my own children and my grandchildren. The sort of, in a way, they are products, aren't they, of the schooling. If they're spoken to all day long, and here's the knowledge, folks. Not a case of, should we just discuss what that point was? Do it within, in your group. Let's have somebody present it back to the main class. I mean, that's simple stuff, isn't it? Really simple stuff. I don't think that happens as often as it ought to.
Well, that's it. And I think one of the things that I noticed, and I was having a discussion, or a close friend of mine, he is head of chemistry over at a sixth form college. And he was saying that one of the most frustrating things was always the fact that he had these students that were getting, they were excelling academically. They were amazing. They were absolutely fantastic, but they weren't getting the university places that they wanted because they weren't able to do the interview side, and they weren't able to sell themselves in that way. And it goes back to one of the hardest things to do as a year 11 form tutor is getting your student to write a personal statement. Because they just don't have this confidence in this ability in themselves to be able to do it in that way. And this is very much that kind of idea that you were talking about.
And it's when you talk to, sorry, Stiles.
I was just going to say, do we knock it out of them? Is what education does is actually knock that out of them. Because if you take a child at 5 and 6, for most children, they're happy to be at the front. They're happy to tell you what's going on. If you've ever, as a head, I know you will have done, Frank, stood at the front of assembly and had some 4-year-old tell you that she's got red shoes on when you're doing something completely, somehow we must knock that out of them if we get to a point where they're not that confident, or that they haven't got the skills to be able to articulate what they need to say.
Let's be honest, when we talk about engagement with business, that's the first thing. If you're a business leader, you've got some a young person coming in for interview or on work experience, that's the first thing you're going to detect, isn't it? Their confidence to be able to be in a group of people that they've never met before, to know how to introduce themselves, to ask some sort of relevant questions, to make it look as though you're listening, even though you might not understand any of it. But all of that is part of the early engagement with a new employer, to make it look as though I'm really interested in this, I want to make a success of it. We don't do enough on that.
And this is where we struggle, isn't it? I mean, this is where it goes back to what I was saying earlier about actual, schools recognizing what oracy actually is, because it's very easy to fall into this trap of, oh, well, it's how they speak to each other. Well, it's not. It's so much more than that. It's how they speak to each other. It's how they listen. It's how they recognize the formality, the audiences. It's the cognitive side of it, the linguistic. It's the body language that's attached to it as well. And what you find more often than not is, and it goes back to this idea of exposure and being a product of where you come from, the fact that actually body language plays a significant part in it. In certain circumstances, because they don't understand the fact that, if they're laid there, kind of like with their arms crossed, or if, that they might be perceived in a certain way, or it might be that it's misinterpreted, so to speak. And it goes back to tone as well. And when you think about breakdowns in communication, and where actually recognizing oracy skills needs to be done on more of a pastoral level. It's about this understanding that actually, more often than not, there's a breakdown in communication that's taken place because a tone has been misinterpreted, or it's not been recognised the right way, or, you know, actually a situation that could have been de-escalated has escalated because everyone's started getting fired up in that way. And it happens a lot more, particularly with those students that aren't given the ability and the exposure to be able to regulate themselves to be able to recognize those signs.
Yeah, I agree. Look, Bronstein, we'll let you have this final say and then we'll get into what's caught our eye this week, because this could well be one of the longest Frankenstein chats of all time.
Doesn't that skill of being able to interpret tone and etc. texting, which will lead me on to what I'm saying later, has highlighted the fact that without body language, without hearing the sounds, you can't actually differentiate between what somebody's tone and what people are saying.
Yeah.
So you know, if anybody needed to know that it's important, it's the number of times things kick off because of a text, because people misinterpret what's written, even though it's written, isn't meant to have gone in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it does. I mean, I'm also mindful of the fact that going back to those young people coming in on work experience, some of them didn't know which hand to use to shake hands with the CEO of the co-op, and also unaware that there are
some... I'm going to be controversial now. Did the CEO know how to fist bump or to do any of that?
Well, some of it was... it was a catalogue of mistakes from the young people, but also being... culturally aware that there are some colleagues who don't want to shake hands, or you perhaps wouldn't shake hands with, you know, and all of that is stuff that you can only really gain from actually real engagement with real people in a real business, you know. So I'm not, this is sort of shifting on to something else. I appreciate that, you know, online work experience is a valuable, has value, but also face-to-face engagement with people that you're not familiar with, you know, in an unusual setting, a new setting, is also valuable. And I don't think it's possible to do this stuff online and then with some of the young people and then think they can just flip it into a real life situation. There's just too much going on in the context of the situation, I think, for some. Anyway, Stan, we got there. That's 20... What's that? That's nearly half an hour. Hey, Stan, what's caught your eye this week?
Very short one, and it leads on from what I've just said on texting. That so I don't even know which organisation it is, but I know there's now been a survey to say whether mobile phones should be banned from under 16-year-olds. And I just think, why are you wasting energy on that? You can't, how would you even police that to begin with? I understand saying, you know, maybe mobile phones aren't something you should have in school. Fine. But the problem we've got with mobile phones is that the thing we get every time there's a new development of technology is that suddenly children can use it better than everybody else. And so the older generation assume that they're wasting their time on it.
Yeah.
I take the point that there are inappropriate things on the internet that you can get through your phone. I think what we need to do is manage that side of things rather than manage the fact that there's a tool there that children will use.
Yes.
I don't know where I stand on the argument.
But to me, this is all we always go back, Stan. In these chats, it's about balance, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's about balance, you know, and actually there are, it saddens me when you see families going out to restaurants. There are two children, two parents perhaps, and the kids are on the iPads. You know, to me, that, I mean, I can understand that if you've been in that restaurant for 2 hours with a 7-year-old, I can understand why you might put an iPad in front of them. But as soon as they sit down, you know, that we were talking before about, you know, teaching people how do you behave, you know, what sort of things happen. I do understand that there are times when you're under so much pressure. It's all about balance, isn't it? About,
yeah. You know, well, I spoke to a teacher yesterday, and just out of interest, said, well, what's happening with phones at your school, primary school? And they said, well, they're allowed to have them, but they're not allowed to have them during the school day. So they can bring them, they have to stay in the bag, and at home time, they can access them. And that's been with a discussion with parents who want, particularly the older ones, to be able to send a message to say I'm on my way home, or you know, there's a problem or whatever.
I feel as though if we were to say to Sarah now, what's the policy at your school, is probably going to end up with a sort of, you know, I'm not quite sure where we'll end up with it. So let's not have that. Let's move on to what's caught your eye this week, Sarah.
So mine is about the recruitment. You may or may not have heard that obviously the National Foundation for Educational Research has just released the projected end of year recruits. And when you look at those in regards to the DfE targets, alarmingly, we are 39%, which was the most recent one. We are 39% under in secondary schools. I mean, I think it just really encompasses. There's a lot going on within secondary schools at the moment. I think we're still playing a lot of catch up. We're closing a lot of gaps. We're experiencing, student experience has had to be adapted, and as a result of that, with the curriculum, and we're still on the end of the changes to the GCSE assessments and the way that those are projected, so that still has an impact as well. I think 39% is particularly alarming when you look at which subjects it is as well. It does appear to be MFL, maths, physics.
I mean, I've got three children. Two of them are primary school teachers. Our son Dom said straight away, "I'm not going to be a teacher," which is, in some respects, great. But actually, you're getting to a point where I'm thinking, was that a good career move for them? Now they've all progressed. They're in sort of leadership roles and whatever. But there is, I think we've spoken before here about, you get to a point where you're, I'm thinking about career changes that, I think when you get to a certain age and you have family responsibilities, whether that's male or female, and some of those intrude, don't they, on your ability to prepare and do some of the other stuff that you used to do. There was a tweet this week, somebody saying, oh, we were inspected by an HMI this week, and she said, I was. Thought I was a really good teacher because people had said I was, but actually, since we've had our ch two children, you know, I haven't got the time to do what I did before that made me a really good teacher, and now I'm starting to question whether or not I am a good teacher, you know, it's all. And she was saying, thinking about those pressures and whether she, you know, where her priorities should be at the moment, you know, and I think our two female children face that pressure more than our son does, and I think that's a real challenge, I think, in terms of, you know, what they do and how the tasks, or what's expected of them, like, for example, a Christmas show or parents' evenings or after school activities that are going on, which some people can commit to, but you know, others can't. You know, I think there's just a lot going on which prevents some people from thinking that this is a good career move for them.
I think there's a real leadership issue there, Frank, isn't there? I mean, you've got to know that some of your best teachers will have those different priorities over their time in school, and you've got to appreciate that at times families will be coming first, and rightly, and therefore you've got to have a balance in your team that means you've got some who are not committed to anything other than school for a period, at the same time when you've got others who are family focused, for rightly so, for a time period. And I think there's a lot of leadership issues around that, about how particularly head teachers view teachers who are having to, not having to, want to spend time with the family and want to commit to family for this period of time.
I find
I
all
think
that.
it's
I
a real
find
issue.
that. I'm sorry about this, but I find any head teacher that says, you know, we think about the business we're in, who then finds it difficult to get their head round those sorts of family pressures, says to me that somebody who's perhaps not had the breadth of training or awareness or whatever it may be, you know, to sort of manage the full range of issues that are going to come their way. You know, I remember teachers coming to me, said, I could tell when they were going to tell me that they were pregnant. I could tell. They'd knock on the door and they'd apologize They'd apologize for being pregnant. And I would say, that this is fantastic news. I mean, they would say, but what are you going to do? Who's going to cover? And, and I feel one of the happiest moments in, from nearly all of them, happiest moments in their lives, to actually sort of feel as if I'm, a leader of a group of young people and the staff, that I'm going to view that in a negative way. I'd
At
want
least not
to make
until
sure
they've gone out of the room, Frank.
that.
And then you go,
Oh no, what am I going to do? No,
okay.
but actually, somebody said, I mean, because this is also about sort of flexibility around work patterns and things like that,
Yeah.
and I, I've always taken the view, I never sought job shares in a primary setting, but actually, two great teachers working together on a job share, you're getting 6.5 days. You really are, So for me, it was never an issue. It was about, we're in the business of bringing children in, up and helping them. We've got to do everything we can to make that work. I'm rabbiting on. It's a lot on me this week.
Did we go down this rabbit hole?
I know. I think I'm
I
in
think
that.
we've gone down this. Yeah, I think I've thrown us down a rabbit hole. I do apologize.
No, don't worry. What's caught my eye this week is the Office of National Statistics issued some information about graduates and young people who had progressed through schooling and had got either a degree or had got a level three or plus qualification. And they actually were on their website, you can put in the name of the town. And actually, it's not just Oldham. You can put in all the surrounding areas for Oldham as well. So there's, I think, 700 towns or cities. So the work I do for the Northern Powers Partnership, this is really quite interesting because we're looking at productivity. And when I look at, well, and so I did a quick search because I've been involved in Blackpool. So it's still, thinking, oh, I'm still feeling part of it. But I chose Oldham as well, Sarah, because I knew you were coming on today. And it's really interesting when you look at the data for a town like Blackpool, the number of graduates and young people getting level three qualifications is really good. It beats the national average. And then other areas like Leeds are below the national average. But what happens is places like Leeds, because they've got the two big universities or three universities, they draw in their graduates, and those like staying in Leeds, so they stay. So those people coming in, those graduates coming in, fill the gaps that the Leeds system has not delivered. Whereas in Blackpool, those people then move out because the job opportunities are not in Blackpool, whereas they are in Leeds. So in a way, it's a sort of vicious circle. So those that are getting rewarded are in effect businesses in Leeds, who are able to draw on the graduate population. And because Blackpool doesn't have its own university, there is that sort of little bit of a brain drain out into other places. They're going to Manchester and to London. So it's really quite interesting because I think for me, it makes me feel as though, well, actually, there's something going on well here in Blackpool. It's not just about the GCSEs, is it? This is something we've been thinking a lot about. It's something about the education experience you get, whether it prepares you, not just now for your GCSEs, but is it preparing you to climb that ladder a little bit later than some other kids? So it's some interesting research. I've just finished it today. So and I think we'll get a bit more of that next week than or the week after. But,
I remember talking to a high school and them saying, well, these are the children from the various primaries that we've had, and some of them do really well and some of them don't, even though they've all come with very similar. And I said, have you spoken to the primary schools about that? About the difference between cohort from cohort down the road, even though they're all at a similar. No. And yet they've got the Fisher Family Trust stuff that is possible to share it with the primary schools to say, look, your children might come with all the right expectation, but within 6 months, they're really not doing as well as children from another school What is it about your preparation that's not working?
Yeah.
We don't share information like that, though.
Right. But it would be nice for a primary
Sarah will tell me
school
that
or
they
even
do
a
that.
secondary school to have an alumni, a proper alumni, so you knew exactly where, many of your children end up. Because it could, I mean, I don't know, some of the stuff you do as a teacher, you think, I enjoy it. I don't know why we're doing, well, I don't know why everybody's doing it. And then you think, well, actually, two of those young people turned into, dancers because I like dancing. And you think, well, I'd like to know a lot more about all of them, but we never get to find that out.
No, it's quite interesting when you say that because we put quite a lot of so secondary schools put quite a lot of energy and effort into, ensuring that those NEET figures stay as low as
No.
possible. So, but then as soon as, like you said, then as soon as that happens and as soon as that's done,
What
you, yeah.
happens? Yeah. Yeah, because
Exactly.
yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is a whole new thing. It's really, to me, it's about eking out, really getting a good understanding of the data, because in those NEET figures, there'll be individuals who are very able. And you have to ask, well, why are you not turning up? Why did you not turn up? What happened? And we need to understand that a bit more, I think, rather than just looking at the data. Anyway, which is what I've been doing this afternoon, just looking at the data. I haven't got any answers. But anyway, Sarah, thank you for joining us.
No,
I hope
thank
it wasn't
you.
too painful. Most people say it wasn't too painful. So we'll be
No, it
disappointed if
wasn't
you
at
say it was
all.
awful. And what I'll do is, for those of you interested in Sarah's book, there'll be a little image of the book at the back at the end of the video. So I'm sure she'll enjoy the royalties if you were to buy it. Next week we don't have a Frankenstein chat weekly one. We do have a spotlight, which is on the we recorded one yesterday with a couple of lecturers at Manchester University on the marketisation of school leadership programmes. Which is quite topical for today. We didn't get onto that, but it is topical. So that'll be broadcast next week, and then we're back the week after. So thank you, Sarah. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And
Thank you,
wish you
Sarah.
well. We'll see you all in
Thank you both.
time. Thank you.
Thank you
Bye
very much.
bye.
Thank you.